This is Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Caritzen. We are coming at you live from the Evolutionary Radio headquarters. As always, my co-host Steve Smee is joining me.
Hey, what's up, guys?
We got another really good guest. Joining us tonight is Austin Stout. So Austin is a certified strength coach, and he holds a Bachelor of Science in Nutrition Science. So Austin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So Austin, for our listeners who don't know much about you, give us a little bit about your background. You know, where did this interest for strength training, nutrition, bodybuilding, where did that all come from for you?
I think like a lot of people kind of started with athletics, you know. I didn't play many traditional sports. I was actually a wrestler and very demanding sport, obviously. And anyone that's done wrestling, boxing, MMA, anything, there's obviously the weight component to it, and a lot of people don't do a very good job managing their weight, you know. So I think that's really where my interest in nutrition and training came. Is I, you know, at a point I was getting to higher level of wrestling, I just thought, man, there's got to be a better way to cut weight. There's got to be a better way to, you know, to maintain my performance. So like all of the nutrition information that I dug into pertained to bodybuilding, and then I slowly realized that bodybuilders or people in this arena were way ahead of pretty much all science. Like, we were already doing what the science, you know, had been telling us. So I'm like, you know, these guys obviously know what's going on. I started weight training I was 16 for sports. It took off from there. After like right after high school, I actually was prepping for my first bodybuilding show my senior year of high school, and then, you know, it's just got by the bug at that point.
How tall are you? How tall are you?
I'm like 5'8", maybe.
Yeah, you're kind of my same, you come from my same background too, because I was more into the weighted sports as well in high school, because we're a short guys, you know, we kind of have the advantage over the tall guys when it comes to stuff like that. We can't play basketball,
right?
But we can damn well sure wrestle and weightlift, you know, because yep. Our height doesn't hurt us in those sports.
Yeah, wrestling is very much like a stylistic thing. You can, you know, it's all about developing style. But, you know, I think after, you know, after that point, there wasn't really anyone. There was people prep coaching at that time, but we didn't have as much Instagram and social media. I don't even think Instagram was a thing, I'm pretty sure. So I didn't even realize that becoming a prep coach and making money was even a possibility until I started getting interested in helping people, and then people offered to pay me. And then I'm like, okay, well, this is, you know, this is potentially a viable career. So I changed my major in college over to nutrition science. I'm like, I'm actually making money at this. I put out content all the time, and it just slowly developed. I mean, I'm glad that I started when I did, simply because the market now is extremely saturated. So, you know, I've got almost 10 years in, and it's starting now versus starting 10 years ago and developing a brand and establishing yourself and getting your reputation out there and stuff, is it's a really tough industry at this point, because there's so many coaches. People don't know who's good, who's bad, and it's definitely tough to get yourself out there.
One topic I wanted to pick your brain about, Austin, you know, being a competitor yourself, having trained so many competitors, is the psychological dangers of competitive physique sports. You know, a lot of people get into bodybuilding, they don't have that healthy relationship with food, self-image to begin with, and then adding in a competitive physique sport just makes it that much worse. So give us your thoughts on this topic. What are some of the things you've seen? Do you think there is a way to bodybuild and not have any, you know, psychological problems? Or do you think it's kind of a part of the sport?
Well, I should have mentioned too that I actually minored in psychology in school, and that was originally what I wanted to go to school for, is to be a psychologist, but I didn't really want to go to school for 8 years. So that was, you know, I kind of scratched that idea. But sport, especially competitive, it really lures in all kinds of disordered thought products, you know, thought patterns, whether it's an eating disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, anything of that nature that's disordered. This is such an appealing arena because it caters to those types of people. So there's a reason that we do well and, you know, in this arena, but there's also obviously huge detriments. I mean, you can take someone, and I get this with client inquiries a lot, like people that have disordered eating backgrounds, and well, their outlet's bodybuilding, which is great, but at what point are you just trading a disorder for a disorder? You know, so how are you going about your bodybuilding? Like what kind of balance and structure are you using? I'm always really hesitant when I get these types of client inquiries that, if they do want to compete, you know, obviously I prep people. I'm not going to say, hey, no, I don't want you to compete, but I'm always real with them. I want people to be able to go through all phases of what it's like to be a bodybuilder before they step on stage. So I want them to see what it's like to get lean. I want them to see what it's like to add calories back in from a lean state and have that psychological transition, like, oh my gosh, I'm gaining weight, I'm gaining body fat, I'm eating more. Like, I want them to see what that feels like and see how they react to it. To do that after their show, I mean, it happens countless times. People, maybe they just don't have a coach that stuck with them, or they don't realize the importance of it. But you get somebody like this that's invested in it, do their first show, okay, you know, obviously way too much body fat back for the show, they have a borderline eating disorder, they're super unhappy with the way they look, and they blame bodybuilding, of course. You know, they're bodybuilding stupid, I'll never compete, no one should ever compete. I mean, I'm sure you guys have seen those posts on Facebook, like bashing bodybuilding such a terrible thing because what it did to me psychologically, and I have this eating disorder and this and that, when in reality they hadn't gone through, you know, year, 2 years, 3 years of these types of cycles to establish like any kind of emotional connection and even know how they were going to react to it. So that's a really common thing.
So Austin, I'm going to ask you a question. I'll let Steve ask you a question. I wanted to know your thoughts on intermittent fasting, because I think intermittent fasting is a great tool, but I generally don't recommend it to my clients who are competitors, because I've found time and time again, it creates a starve, binge, suffer cycle. And, you know, a lot of competitors kind of have that voice in the back of their head telling them, you know, restrict calories, restrict calories, restrict calories. And they love intermittent fasting, right? Because it's like, oh, I haven't eaten anything all day. You know, I'm doing so good. And then when they finally start eating, almost that, you know, effort effect goes on. They're just like, well, I ate 1,000 calories. I might as well eat 2,000, might as well eat 3,000. No. So what are your thoughts on intermittent fasting? Have you found a way to incorporate it in client programs without having that binge side effect occur?
A really good question. I don't think I've ever heard anyone ask me that. I've talked about it before, but I'm glad you asked that. So like fasting in general, we know there's health benefits to it. So that, you know, that's kind of here nor there. I mean, there's science behind that, whatever, but there's a lot of things. Fasting, you know, just like really loose macro counting, like the really liberal IIYFM type approach and things like that. All of those things lend themselves to like you take some like thing that's supposed to be healthier and help you, or IIYFM that's supposed to allow you to eat these foods. And next thing you know, you're taking intermittent fasting. You're seeing like how much volume of food cram into meals. You're like, oh, I have 1,500 calories in this meal. See how much like thickeners and sweeteners and like, you know, what kind of 5-pound pudding you make and eat in this meal and then wreck your GI tract. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's a really valid question, and I'm always hesitant to use that on somebody that would maybe that I know has these types of tendencies to binge and restrict and that nature. So I wouldn't ever suggest it, but definitely hesitate with certain people. And say, I mean, something like I could try it and get their feedback on it. And if they are getting into any kind of pattern like that, I could always pull back. I mean, they're giving me feedback, but yeah, I think that's actually a really good question. And I don't use it a lot for that reason. And I also don't use super loose macro counting for that reason. I do have people that count macros, but you know, we try to consolidate it into certain foods and things like that, just because it does become like a game. Like, how long can I fast? How much can I cram into these meals? Like, how much volume? And you know what, though? I'll be completely 100% honest. I've done it myself. My calories get super low when I prep. I'm like, how can I make this? Like, how can I make this meal huge? You know what I mean? And then next thing I know, like, I'm wrecking my GI tract because I have like 15 grams of guar gum in there, trying to like thin it and make it, you know, huge and ridiculous. So, that was a really good question. I definitely agree.
Steve, what are your thoughts on this? I know you intermittent fast regularly.
Well, we're talking about my thoughts, but I kind of want to talk a little bit because I did some digging on your Instagram. I'd like to do homework on our guests.
Okay.
And I do notice you do mention some fasting on there. So what kind of fasting are you experimenting with yourself and with your clients? And I'm not sure if we hit on this to start, but do you also train like regular Joes or is it just competitors?
I'd say my clients are about 50-50. As far as and I actually train several athletes too. Like, I have some that compete like NCAA level sports, college, professional, high school, all stuff like that. I do enjoy training athletes. It's a little bit different component, but I mean, I'm kind of all over the board as far as what I do. It's just that a lot of what I talk about is more of the bodybuilding, you know, related stuff online. As far as like fasting goes, I do use intermittent fasting with people. I mean, I do have clients that use it. It works for their schedule, you know. I have no problem with using it as long as it's not creating any kind of bad relationship, like Trevor was talking about. Yeah, I'll use it for more therapeutic purposes too. So, like, maintaining insulin sensitivity, you know, GI tract function. Like, for example, use it in a deficit or a surplus. Like, I have guys that genuinely get into a surplus and they're bigger, muscular guys, and they legitimately need to eat 6,000 plus calories. You know what I mean? Like, they're eating 400 grams of protein, they're eating 700 grams of carbs, they're eating 150, 200 grams of fat. You know what I mean? So it's like inflammatory, is really hard on your GI tract. So I'll implement periodic fasting if things get backed up, you know, with them. It might just be a 24-hour fast where we'll clean things out, get their blood glucose to come down a little bit, clean out the inflammation a little bit. They feel better. They're ready to eat. They're ready to continue. So, I mean, I can use it in a therapeutic way like that, or I've also used it for purposes. So one thing that I did with a client recently, well, I've done it with a few people. Actually, you know, I'll use my wife as an example. I use her all the time. I don't really care. She has some other underlying health issues that make her appetite really strange. And I'll actually do one way that I create a deficit with her. Like, she wants to lose fat. Is I primarily use fasting. So let's say she's eating 2,000 calories a day, and then I want to create a deficit. I'll literally just go every other day fast. I did that with her. It's the strangest thing. I mean, I did it with her for 4 months. Like, she would literally only eat every other day. She ate on her training days. The days she trained, she ate normally. She would have four meals, like normally 4 to 5 meals. I would hit her macros. She would fast on each non-training day during the week. And it worked for her excellent. By the day she was supposed to eat, her appetite was awesome. She was ready to eat.
So what were her results doing that every other day fasting thing? What was the before and after? How long did she do that, and what ended up happening?
Well, the thing is, the way that I structured it, or the way that I'm weird example, I know, but let's say I want to create or calorie deficit for the week. You know, obviously numbers aren't not everything. Your body's going to metabolically adapt, but I wanted calorie deficit for the week. All I'm going to do is I'm going to create that through those fasting days. That's all I'm doing. So really the results isn't going to be any different than if I were to just pull calories from every day, a smaller amount from each day. It's really going to be a similar result. Just that she feels better, appetite's better, appearance is better. So that's really why I'm using it. It's fat loss, because when you're in a fat loss phase anyhow, you're not really using fasting as much for insulin sensitivity, blood sugar control, things like that. Extent you can, but I mean, if you're losing body fat and you're eating less and you're doing cardio and stuff, your blood glucose is already going to go down, your nutrient partitioning is already going to go up, your insulin sensitivity is already going to go up. All of those things are going to be enhanced already for the most part. Fasting might help a little bit more, but it's not going to be as beneficial. Like, I really like to use fasting more so in, heavy caloric surplus phases for those therapeutic purposes, like I said, to be completely honest.
Austin, your audio is a little bit jumpy. I'm not sure if you need to maybe move your microphone a little bit closer.
Yeah.
One question I had for you is when it comes to training, you know, your wife or someone you're dating or a close family member, have you ever ran into issues like that? Like, I, as a general rule, will not train someone I have dated. I will not train a family member. Do you have any issues training your wife, or has it been pretty successful?
It's definitely been successful. I probably work with about 10 of my family members, like, and mostly immediate. Mostly we're on her side of the family. My wife, see, the only difference is she has a lot of other underlying things that, I mean, it's not her fault, just health stuff. Just truly feel that I can better understand it because I go to doctor's appointments with her and I do all of these things with her, you know what I mean? So one of the main reasons, I mean, yeah, there's been times where she doesn't want to listen to me. We don't train together like 99% of the time for that reason. So there's always that component there. It does work for us. I will say that definitely doesn't work for a lot of people. And I have tons of guys that have, I'll work with their wife or their girlfriend or whatever, and they're themselves. And I know that they're perfectly capable of working with their significant other. It's just a conflict of interest. So, like, I have a guy right now, he's a good coach. He's the other that hosts one of the podcasts that I do. And I train his girlfriend or his fiance. I train him and his fiance. Well, he doesn't train his fiance because they would kill each other. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I don't think it works for a lot of people. Fortunately, it does work for us. Saves me some money too. I don't have to pay anyone, but that's always a plus.
So, Austin Stau, if you guys go on Instagram, you can check out his Instagram. He has some really impressive transformations and pictures as well. So I noticed, Austin, you're doing something I'm doing right now, and that is wearing blue blockers.
Say something about it.
I noticed that. So I did my homework on you, and I know you like to wear blue blockers. What made you do that, and how long you been doing that?
I'm kind of I don't know. My wife says I'm a hippie, but I don't think I'm necessarily a hippie, but I do some weird like ritual, you know, ritual stuff as far as sleep goes. And, classes just make sense to me. They literally cost like $15 on Amazon at most, if you get a really good pair. And I swear, I'll literally, like, say it's about 8:30 now. I've been on my computer since 6 o'clock this morning, and that's almost every single day. But I mean, I'll break it up and I'll go train. But I mean, I train at my house because I train in my barn. I come back in, like, I'm literally on the computer all day up until I go to bed a lot of the time. So the glasses are definitely beneficial in emitting the blue light and the air and things like that. Been it for about a year and a half. Do all kinds of goofy stuff. I don't know how much you guys want to hear, but I mean, I sleep with earplugs and an eye cover. I have a weighted blanket to sleep with. I do, oh man, all kinds of shit. So kind of a different conversation.
Sleep is important for sure.
What's the purpose of the weighted blanket? Like, I understand the earplugs, I understand the eye cover. Wouldn't a weighted blanket, wouldn't that almost make you sweat more?
Well, the material doesn't really make me sweat. The material actually feels pretty cool, but they originally used weighted blankets, and I'm not on this topic. They originally used weighted blankets in like a therapeutic setting for people with anxiety disorders. So, or like separation disorders, and it wouldn't have to be for bedtime. They're sitting on the couch, you know what I mean? And they need the weight is supposed to represent touch. It gives you that stimulation of touch of a human being because of the weight. I don't think that helps you sleep better at all, like quality wise, but what I will say, it definitely helps me fall asleep better. So for anyone that has anxiety or like the racing thoughts before they go to bed, just have a hard time shutting their brain off. I found that's pretty helpful.
Do you have a dog, Austin?
Do I have a dog?
Yes.
I have two dogs and...
Because they sell something for dogs for thunderstorms and for... And I used to have a dog scared of thunderstorms and I forgot what they call it, but you put it on them, it's really, really tight and it's something similar to what you're saying, right? You know what I'm talking about? I think it's called a thunder shirt or something.
It's the exact same concept. Yeah. It's just for people. Like originally they didn't use these for normal people that didn't have the disorder like me, but on that, okay, you know, it can be useful for people. And of course somebody thought they could make money on it. So now you can buy them on Amazon or wherever. I didn't know if it would help for sure, but we'll say that it definitely does help me fall asleep quicker. So, you know, it's money well spent.
Yeah, I notice I sleep better when there's a chick sleeping next to me. So maybe there is merit to that. But yeah. We don't know. So what other little tricks do you have up your sleeve? The blue blockers, a weighted blanket helps you sleep. If we don't sleep, we don't gain. So, I mean, what are some other tricks that you have up your sleeve, whether it be sleep or anything else that separate your success from, you look back and be like, man, I wish I would have done that. For me, I'll bring up an example, stand-up desk. I wish I'd gotten a stand-up desk 20 years ago. I have chronic neck and shoulder issues from sitting on my ass, like what you were saying, for 10 hours a day on the computer. So that's something I wish I could take a time machine and do. What's something for you, because it has affected my training, you know, these neck issues. So what are some other little tricks you have up your sleeve?
You mean in terms of sleep or just in general?
Yeah, anything that affects our gains or fat loss, you know?
Okay. Interested, I can throw you guys a link sometime if you remind me. I did write an article, pretty in-depth article, like on sleep for, I think it was for Elite FTS. Like it was just about how to create the best sleep environment. Like what you should do in your bedroom and all this stuff, what you should do before bed. But other stuff, one thing that I went through, and a lot of people that know me listening to this, you know, they've heard me talk about, is I went through some adrenal issues for a while. So one thing I got really interested in was balancing my nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system and sympathetic nervous system, and learning the benefits of balancing the two and what that can do for me. So I say some little things that I do, like make sure that I'm calm before I eat meals. And that's actually helped my digestion significantly, because I get so, I get so busy. I'm like furiously typing or whatever. And the sympathetic drive that we have from stress or from stimulants, like opposite of what we want for digestion, for sleep, for relaxation. So it'd be something super simple. Like I notice that I need to eat, I'm really busy typing, whatever, I'll stop. I'll do 10 soft belly breaths, let everything calm down, close my eyes for 5 seconds, good to go. I can eat. And it doesn't, like, I would get so worked up and so into my work that I would be eating. I knew my stomach would start hurting. You know what I mean? Like, my blood flow was clearly not focused on digestion. I was stressed out. Like, the thing, stress too, is that we operate on this idea of perceived well-being. Like, people are so used to feeling a certain way. Like, if they're just mildly or moderately stressed all the time, it's not enough to where they notice it. So they just kind of, they walk around stressed constantly because it's what they're used to. They aren't cognizant of it. So they're just literally stressed all the time. Pretty common for a lot of people. So just being aware of things like that, controlling stress, controlling these stress response to stupid stuff, like you're in traffic. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, this person really pissed me off. Well, do I really need to scream at them and get pissed and like my cortisol, my adrenaline levels up? I need to do that. I need mad when my puppy is, you know, on my floor. Well, yeah, it's really frustrating, but do I really need to do that? It's like, you think about it, you took all the little things that off in a day and you eliminated 10 things, how many less times you were activating your sympathetic nervous system, how many less times you were elevating cortisol, and how many less times you were elevating adrenaline and the other stress hormones. So I would say just being aware of stress and trying to respond to it better is probably the best thing I've ever done, because my adrenal issues were pretty bad for a while. It's just because I was stressed all the time and I didn't control it worth a shit. It was my fault. It wasn't anyone else's fault.
I find the reason why a lot of bodybuilders are suffering from digestive issues is exactly what you said. They're not chewing their food. They're almost like inhaling their food. And especially in a pre-contest scenario, you know, when you're really hungry, you'll like eat that meal in 2 minutes. So one thing I'll sometimes recommend to someone who's experiencing digestive issues, they'll say, in the middle of your meal, set a minute timer. And for a minute, don't do anything. And it really just slows you down, having that minute break in between your meal. Another thing you can do is you can eat with a teaspoon instead of a tablespoon. Oh, and that'll force you to slow down. And another thing, which is really helpful, and people almost look at me like I'm crazy when I suggest it, is eat doing nothing. Like, eat staring at a blank wall. When you do that, and especially, you know, you're a couple weeks out from your show and you actually like focus on eating, you feel so much more satiated after that meal. Because if you're on your phone, if you're on your computer, if you're watching TV and you eat, you're not focusing on the fact you're eating. And it's almost like in the back of your head, you don't feel near as satiated. But one thing I wanted to ask you, Austin, because you hear so many mixed opinions on this, is there any foods before bed that you try to avoid? Or is there any foods in particular you do eat before bed to help you sleep?
I wouldn't say there's anything directly that I'm avoiding, unless somebody, I do have some people that are working on like a acid reflux issue, or they have GERD or something like that, where it does bother them if they eat a bunch of food before bed and lay down. You know what I mean? Like that will bother them just because of the reflux. But, you know, I did a lot of research on this, and I found that I couldn't really convince myself one way or the other. Is I know, you know, we carbohydrates before bed, for example, like we're going to help boost serotonin levels. That's going to help relax us. That's probably help us calm down and get to sleep. Now, I also found some information that said that eating certain things or certain interactions with insulin and glucose before bed could interrupt melatonin production as well. So it's like, well, you know, it's where's the trade-off there? So I let people, I just try to see how people feel, to be honest. Like, I normally have zero issue with people eating before bed, but I do have people that just genuinely sleep worse, eat before bed. Me personally, before bed, and that worked for me. And I do feel a difference, as you know, versus not eating before bed. I have other people that just don't, they do not sleep well. And it could be neurotransmitter reaction or hormonal, like I mentioned, could just be psychological. I mean, the obvious thing is like somebody's really hungry before they go to bed. That's not very comfortable. I mean, nobody, I really don't know anyone that likes to go to bed with their stomach growling and hunger pangs, but I've seen it both ways, man. Like I go a lot of ways on a lot of things just because I try to be open-minded, because the more you do it, the more you're going to find it. There's always that one outlier. That's why when I don't even hardly get in arguments and stuff on social media, because there's literally no absolute in anything. You know what I mean? It's so hard to say, yeah, this is the best or this is the worst. And it drives me nuts when people do that, because it's like there is no absolutes. You know, if you do it long enough, you'll eventually find someone that breaks the rules. So.
Steve, do you have any more questions, or do you want me to introduce your second topic?
Well, on the Digest Sims, I also noticed on your Instagram too, like I said, I do my homework on our guests, Trevor and I are very good at doing that. You also have Sack Boulardi as a recommended probiotic. And one of the things that bothers me, is that there's all these probiotics out there, and honestly, like, I think most of them are bullshit and they don't do shit. But Sack Boulardi is the one that I actually recommend, because that was the one that I used to get me back on track after I used antibiotics. So why do you recommend Sack Boulardi on your page? Is it the same, you have the same experience?
I'm glad that you pronounced it, because I don't even know how to pronounce it. So, it's one of the most researched, and you know, it seems to be most resistant to all the other stuff that kind of like probiotics, like temperature, shelf stable, obviously like stuff sits in warehouses that has to get transported, imported, exported, whatever. So it seems like one of the very few that when you get it, it's a live bacteria, it works for you. I mean, obviously like storage and stuff and manufacturing makes it, but I mean, all the research was there. I tried it, and it was actually like, oh wow, I noticed a difference between, is like if you actually get very few probiotic formulas that are potent, who have some efficacy, you'll notice that if you take, let's say, 5 billion CFU, a pretty lowish dose, and then products that are reported to be 300 or 500, you know, in CFU, and did nothing. You know what I mean? Because they're garbage. All the bacteria is probably dead in there. But yeah, my favorite strand that I always start with most people, because my experience is similar to yours, that probably 95% of products are either have zero potency, or they just don't work. I mean, for whatever reason, whether it's a manufacturing thing, a shelf life thing, or whatever, they just literally don't work. And that's one of the ones that I found to be beneficial.
So probiotics are a really, really interesting topic. It's something I've done a lot of research on. The problem with probiotics is that a lot of the probiotics being sold aren't actually human strain. So they might not even benefit you, right? Because it's like if you swab your computer desk, there's trillions of different types of bacteria on there, right? So there's so many different types of bacteria, and the average person, they don't even know, you know, the difference between human strain, non-human strain. So a lot of companies will use cheaper bacteria strains that are just very, very generic, but because they're not the bacteria that's actually living inside of your microbiome, it's not really doing you any good. It's kind of just like in and out. So that's probably why it wouldn't be the fact that the bacteria is better than a different probiotic. It's just that I'm guessing that brand chose specific human strain bacteria that actually have, you know, some scientific evidence on improving digestion or whatever.
Would definitely make sense. And I'm going to hit up Clean that you mentioned too, because I have some things I want to talk to her about. I did a little bit of research on cool stuff like, fecal testing, and actually some newer stuff like fecal transplants that they're doing in people, and some really interesting microbiome stuff. So yeah, that's a cool topic. And once I get her on, I'll let you guys know.
Yeah. And another thing is people think like bacteria your intestines, right? But bacteria is it's an entire body, right? Like it's on your skin, it's in your gastrointestinal tract, you know, it's in your mouth, it's in everything, right? So people, like, one big mistake we make here in North American medicine is that we study the liver, you know, like we study the liver in isolation, but your liver creates bile salts, which help your body immobilize fats. You know what I mean? So it's like, you can't really study just an organ by itself because all of your organs work in conjunction with one another. So what I really like about acupuncture in traditional Chinese medicine is rather than studying an organ, they study systems. Like they'll study the detoxification system or the digestive system. I think that's much smarter, at least in the way my mind thinks, because you can't really just study, you know, your bicep, because when you do a bicep curl, well, your hand has to grip the weight. And then, you know, the forearm is the lever to actually get your bicep to contract the muscle. And then while your bicep's contracting, your tricep is stretching, and those are all attached to your arm bone, right? So it's like it's way more complicated than, oh, let's just study the bicep.
Yeah, and that's like the same thing with coaching, with what we're doing. I mean, you have to look at an issue a lot of the time is systemic, you know what I mean? It's throughout the body. A great example would be just inflammation. Well, I have a GI issue, my blood glucose levels are high, or my white blood cells are high on my lab work, all these things. Well, I just come to find out that they're really stressed and systemically inflamed, and it's causing all of these body systems to be interrupted. I mean, you're absolutely right. Learning how everything, you know, the feedback loops, and learning how to read lab work and learning how to do those things is definitely really important. I know you guys probably have experience with doctors and stuff, working with clients go to doctors, you get feedback, and it is extremely difficult to find a medical practitioner that views the body in that way.
Which brings us to our second topic, and that is biofeedback from your training. So Austin, with your own training and then with your clients, with their training, what are some things that you look for to make sure that, you know, they're not overtraining, they're seeing the results that they're looking for? And then for our listeners, what are some things that they should try to be cognizant of when, you know, they're making a workout program and sort of assessing whether or not it's the right workout program for them?
Really hard thing about this is that I should decipher a novice, you know, beginner versus someone that's intermediate or advanced. Is if you're if you're a novice or a beginner, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to have, you know, here's my template, this is what I do each week. You got to learn the feedback. You've got to go through the situations to see, all right, how does my nervous system feel? You know, am I recovering? Am I progressively overloading? Am I getting stronger? You're not going to know those things if you've never done it. But for a more advanced trainee, like I'll obviously have a template that I give them, you know. One question is, well, how many weeks are we going to do this? And I'll normally say, I have no idea. I mean, it could be, it could really suck when we change it after 1 week. I mean, I've had people that they've literally progressed on the same template and they're just kind of on that cusp of overreaching, but they never really overreach or overtrain. You know, they're in that like perfect groove for 4 months, 5 months. Like it, you know, it does happen. As far as like, you know, obvious signs of overtraining, anything interrupting your nervous system. I mean, the first one's probably going to be, in my experience, things outside of the gym, because I feel like most people kind of mask the stuff in the gym if they're a little bit overtrained or a little bit tired. Like they'll just take more stimulants, or they're just, you know, or they'll just get a little more hyped up to train, and they know that, hey, I have to hit this weight. So they're mentally, they're going to be able to hit it. Outside the gym, the other things start suffering. I mean, whether that's their sleep quality or just their energy throughout the day, finding that they're getting huge energy dips and crashes at certain times of day that they didn't have before. They're getting irritable. Their recovery is not as good. But just some of my own adrenal issues. And I was almost embarrassed when I found out how bad they were, because still going in the gym and hitting all the weights and stuff that I was supposed to, because I had this mentality that I know what I have to do in the training session. If I have to go over and beat my head on the wall to get motivated enough to do it, then that's what I'll do. And I could still mask, even though my body was destroyed, I was able to do that in the gym. But outside the gym, I was a wreck. You know what I mean? So I think a lot of people pay attention to all of the things in the gym when really they need to look at biofeedback outside the gym first and foremost.
I loved what you said, Austin, because I went through the exact same thing. I was still getting stronger on lifts, right? Like I was still beating the logbook, but outside of, you know, the 2 hours when I was in the gym, I was an absolute mess. Like I felt like a walking zombie. And, you know, most bodybuilders are type A persons. You know, we always want to do more. If four squats of sets is good, if four sets of squats is good, five has to be really good. Six has to be really, really good, right? So I really had to learn through the school of hard knocks that it's about the quality of your workout, not the quantity. And, you know, even if you're getting good results in the gym, if you can't function throughout the day, if you can't, you know, stay up and you're like falling asleep at work and stuff, that's a red flag.
Yeah. No, I agree. I totally agree. And you have to, I mean, obviously you have to look at other stressors as well, like life stressors, you know, hey, did you get a new job? Do you have like something going on with the family? You're getting less sleep. Like all of those things matter. What's interesting is, let's say I'm looking at, let's say someone has really, everything's going really well, nothing changes, and then I notice that they're starting to show signs of you getting into that overtraining territory. I think 9 times out of 10, most of the stuff that's causing them to overtrain isn't even their training. Because maybe if their training stays level, like as far as I didn't add volume in, I didn't add intensity in, you know, nothing like that. It's probably because I'll start digging and asking questions. Well, come to find out they're getting less sleep. They just got a job promotion that's, you know, making them work 4 extra hours every day. And they had, you know, whatever, I'm just making stuff, obviously. But none of these things are even related to their training or nutrition. And these are all of the things that are causing their training, causing them to overtrain. Why? All of those other things are cutting into the recovery ability that their training was using before. You know what I mean? So now, less recovery ability, less sleep, you know, yada, yada, yada. And then end up overtrained, even though they didn't even do anything different in the gym. So I think people just ignore all of those things. They just push through it. And next thing you know, they realize, like, oh, wow, I'm overtrained. I don't understand why, because I haven't changed my training. You know what I mean? So I see that pretty commonly.
I'll say one more thing, though, let Steve jump in here. One thing to remember is that even good stress is stress, right? So let's say you have a huge dinner party, you know, you have 20 people over, you know, that's great. You know, it's exciting. You got a lot of friends over, but you're still stressed because, you know, you're worrying about if you prepared enough food, if your guests are going to enjoy the meal, if everything's going to be ready on time. You know, same with starting a new job. Like, you know, that's exciting, but it's still stressful. So Steve, give us your thoughts on this topic.
Well, let me tell you something. I mean, it's a lifestyle. So, I mean, all our members know that I stress to people, you really have to change, you know, the way you approach things. And it's a long-term thing. How old are you, Austin?
I'll be 28 here pretty soon. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah, you're still definitely, yeah, still young for sure. So, but let me ask you this, Austin, because I know you said, earlier that you like to work out from home, but I'm assuming you do go to you know to gyms and stuff for clients, correct? A lot.
The reason I work out at home now, it's kind of a long story. I owned a gym for about 2 years. We closed the gym. I took a lot of the equipment and I train at home now.
Oh, okay. So you've been in the gym a lot. So this is the thing I like to ask our guests. Because there's no right or wrong answer to this. I just want to pick their brains and hear their opinions on this. So my question is, when you know, being in the gym, what are some of the things you notice that people are doing wrong in the gym as far as training? You know, what are they doing and that they should correct? Because a lot of our listeners, let's face it, you know, a lot of them, unfortunately, they're going to quit. You know, they might work out for like a year or two and they're like, fuck, I'm not getting results, and they'll quit. But what are some things that can kind of help them get the results that they're looking for and keep them going? What are some things that people are doing wrong that you notice when you're in the gym?
You know, and this one seems really simple, but I would actually, as far as to say, this is for people that have been training a long time too, even competitors. Just like Trevor said, quality of training. Honestly, I can handle less total amount of work in the gym now. I was 20. And the reason is because my sets are a lot harder. You know, my ability to contract the muscle is a lot better. Like, more efficient when I train, you know. So what gets me sometimes is let's say I have a client from out of town come in, because all my clients are all over the place. Say somebody drives in, come to see me, go to the gym, get a session in, and they're, you know, I've been writing their programs, and maybe I'm using like some kind of intensity scale. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the RPE scale, you know, on the program. So I say, okay, we're going to do whatever exercise, we're going to work up to an RP of 10, which is going to be failure, obviously. So we do it, we work up. I get up to their set. I don't say anything. I want to see them do it without me saying anything. Do it, and I'm like, well, there you go. You just did an RP of 6. You know what I mean? So, of course, they perceived it as a 10, but my point being is that their intensity was just nothing. I mean, they had tons of reps left in the tank. And of course, just training hard is probably the biggest mistake that most people make. I mean, I think it's safe to say. I mean, obviously, like, you can't just be doing a million sets to failure, because then you're going to have the same adrenal issues that we talked about. But at the same time, I normally, if someone's in the gym for 2.5 hours, unless they're a power lifter and they're training with a group of guys, there's no way 99% of the time that they had a good workout and they trained intensely. It's just not really possible with that kind of time.
Steve, your mic's on mute.
Yeah, you're muted, buddy.
Sorry. What I was going to say is most of our guests that have come on have mentioned intensity. So that's been the prevalent theme. And I think that's true, because I always see the same people in the gym. They're back in the corner of the gym on the elliptical, jerking off for 45 minutes, like on low level. And they just never change what they look like. It's like, dude, I mean, if you're going to do the elliptical, at least raise the intensity, you know? I mean, they just sit there like, you know, for 45 minutes just watching Jerry Springer on the little TV there. And it's just like, what's the point? So piggybacking on that, the people that are coming to you, what are the mistakes they're doing with diet when in terms of losing weight? Because let's face it, 90% of the guys listening to this podcast are overweight and they want to lose weight. I mean, it's rare, you know, that we see guys complain, yay, I can't gain weight, I can't gain weight. Seems like it's so easy to be overweight these days. So what are some things that they can change to kind of get their weight loss down in terms of diet?
So now with the internet and with all of the information at our disposal, I think even like people that have no idea about bodybuilding are starting to learn about calories at least a little bit, about macronutrients at least a little bit. There's a ton of people that don't. They just think, I need to eat cleaner, I need to stop eating sugar or whatever bullshit that they see on TV. But in general, I will say that anyone that does any kind of research, they can see, okay, basic concept. I need to, here's this macro counter. It plugs in my macros or whatever. So they do that, they get some good results. Let's say they understand at least concept of a consistent regimen. What I would see for most beginners or just novice people is to the point where their metabolism slows down, you know, those adaptions occur, then they don't know what to do from there. So that's really, I mean, and that's what a coach is for. That's really where a coach comes into play. You know, you can, if you are new to this and you're trying to lose weight, you're trying to gain muscle, it's like you can pretty much find solid starting point if you Google it, most likely. Problem is, it's not going to take you any further than that. You know what I mean? A feedback we talked about with training. You're not going to know how to read that. You're not going to know how to adapt to training. Your metabolism slows down. Those metabolic adaptations are occurring. Your hormones are going down. All of these things. You're experiencing inflammation, gastrointestinal issues, all these things we talked about. You don't know how to do that. You don't know how to, you know, combat these things. You don't know how to fix them. So, you know, I think that most newer people just run into issues. Maybe they get the real basic calorie counting. They just don't understand how to balance all of the environmental factors, all of the adaptive factors, and all those things once things start to slow down. So that's the best I can answer that question.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough question to answer. So tell us, Austin, how can our listeners get in touch with you if they would like some of your counsel on this stuff?
Yeah, sure. So there are a couple ways. Facebook, Austin Stout on Facebook, pretty easy to find. You know, there's like a million bodybuilding pictures and every post is about something bodybuilding related, so you'll know who I am. And Graham, I am Austin ST8. Find me on there. Email is EAS and the number 4. And I still sport an AOL.com email. So you guys can find me there. I use email for barely anything, but you can obviously contact me on the social media stuff and I can give you information and direct you in the right place. And then if you guys want to check out my podcast and stuff, I have all that stuff linked up. I have a YouTube channel that you can find all that stuff linked in the bios on my Facebook and Instagram. So it's really easy to find.
Austin, this is close to our 200th episode.
Sweet.
The only guest we have booked who still uses an AOL email.
Dude, I'm going to tell you what. There's still a few guys using AOL emails. So don't give me a hard time. Come on.
An email is an email. It really makes no difference.
It doesn't make any difference.
The nice thing about Gmail, though, is because it's now linked to also YouTube and everything, it's just like one login, so you're logged in for everything. So especially like if you're uploading videos constantly and like then you can see your notifications, everything. It's kind of a little bit easier to have it all in one place, but I mean, that's an email.
Yeah. And I use like for client stuff, I'll use a lot of like Excel documents and things like that. So, I mean, everyone, like I said, like we talked about, everyone has their system, you know,
I use Excel too, because then when you're calculating their macros and calories, you can like sum it and everything. Like, it's just, I don't get how, like, if someone's going to use a Word document, are they using, like, a calculator to add it all? Like,
I've seen tons of plans where the coach doesn't even have the macros calculated, and I'll get an inquiry where somebody had a plan, and I'm like, well, what, do you know the macros? I mean, I can count them, but if you know them, it helps me out. Well, my coach never had the macros calculated. He just pulled in, he just put food in and took food out when we needed to. I'm like just randomly. I mean, no numbers at all. But yeah, interesting.
I guess we're not as smart as them. We need to use numbers.
I mean, I guess not.
For your host, Trevor Kuritzen, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and for our special guest, Austin Stout, this has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life, look good doing it. Thanks for listening. Thank you.